It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Do we as American citizens have a right to vote in elections? In practice, it seems like we do. But take a look at the U.S. Constitution. Look for a line like this. Any person who has attained the age of 18 shall be entitled to vote. You won't find it there because that's from the basic law in Germany. And you won't really find any basic guarantee of a right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. Our next guest says the absence of a constitutionally defined positive right to vote is a big problem that leads to a lot of our debates about voting laws in the U.S. today. And he says we need a constitutional amendment to fix that problem. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the U.S. Constitution be amended to guarantee a right to vote? Do you have questions about how that could work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Richard Hassan is a law professor at UCLA. His latest book is A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back with you.
Rick, people might be surprised. We assume we have a right to vote, but the Constitution doesn't really lay that out in plain terms.
That's right. If you go back to the original Constitution, state legislatures chose presidential electors. State legislatures chose senators. That didn't change until the 20th century with the 17th Amendment passage. And as to the House of Representatives, it said, yeah, we're going to have an election, but who can vote in that election is up to the states to decide on qualifications. And over time, we've amended the Constitution to prevent certain forms of discrimination, like on the basis of gender or race. But we've never said that there is an affirmative right to vote. And as recently as 2000, in the Bush versus Gore case that ended the dispute over the 2000 election and the Florida's Electoral College votes, the Supreme Court said state legislatures could take back for future elections the ability to choose electors themselves. And we don't have a right to vote for president.
But people might say, okay, no big deal. In practice, we keep expanding the franchise to more and more people over time. We have this presumption that we're going to do things in elections. Courts will save us from those rights being infringed. So no harm there. You tackle that objection in your book. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say over time, the courts have not been the great protector of voting rights. So I tell some stories in the book. For example, in 1874, a woman named Virginia Minor went to the Supreme Court and said, I'm a citizen adult resident. They're not letting me vote in Missouri because I'm a woman. And the 14th Amendment guarantees me in the Constitution the privileges or immunities of citizenship. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, you are a citizen, but that's not a privilege or immunity of citizenship. That's a question of state law. Similarly, or even worse, in 1903, a man named Jackson Giles went to the Supreme Court and said, Alabama's not letting me vote, even though I'm an adult citizen male. Why can't I vote? And it was because he was black and they wouldn't register him. And the Supreme Court said, even though there was a 15th Amendment, sorry, we're not going to enforce that. It wasn't until Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that we had effective representation for black voters in the South and in other parts of the country. Throughout time, it's been a struggle. It hasn't been a constant expansion of enfranchisement. And even today, there are lots of pockets of people who face barriers to voting that really are not justified. And so one of the things the amendment would do is it would affirmatively state that we have these rights, and especially because the Supreme Court may no longer recognize some of the rights to vote that it did earlier during the period that we refer to as the Warren Court in the 1960s.
Let's dive into the amendments that you're proposing, suggesting. You've got a couple different versions. I want to start with the clean one that focuses really straightforwardly on saying, hey, yes, you have a constitutional right to vote. You've got it broken into six parts. What are the key elements that you would want to see in an amendment like that?
Sure. And I should say before I go through each part that I've got three goals. One is to assure political equality, the idea that all of us who are eligible to vote should have an equal chance to vote. Second, we have too much election litigation. This is something that you in Wisconsin know all too well. My amendment would lower the amount of election litigation and the risk of stolen elections, of election subversion. There are things we can do to make it harder to protect our democracy. So what do I do? First and foremost, every citizen, adult, resident, non-felon would have the right to vote for president and for other offices. Those votes would be equally weighted. when states impose burdens on voting or on registration, they'd have to come up with good reasons. It would change how the courts do the balancing in those cases to put a thumb on the scale favoring voters. I would also direct the Supreme Court and lower courts to be more deferential to Congress when they expand voting rights. And I would require registration of all eligible voters, coupled with a national kind of identification, which would eliminate a lot of litigation, ensure our elections are being done fairly and with integrity. And finally, I would enshrine in part of the Const I would enshrine this constitutional amendment, part of the Voting Rights Act that protects minority voters and assures that they have a fair chance to be able to elect a candidate of their choice.
Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You could join in with your thoughts on his idea, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Okay, people might say, hey, I find it as a citizen pretty easy to register to vote now. Okay, yeah, we've got voter ID in Wisconsin. That's a little bit of a hurdle, but not a big deal. What would you say to people who say, you know, I don't think I'd see much difference under that basic guarantee of a right to vote?
Well, it may be that for a particular person, if they're lucky enough to live in the right place where they have the right ID, or they live in the place where they don't face a particular barrier, then it's not a big deal for them. And I would say we should worry about others. And I give some examples. For example, I talk about how in North Dakota, the state legislature, seeing that Native American voters were supporting Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat who was a U.S. senator from the area, imposed a residential address requirement in order to vote. Now, for most people, producing your residential address, saying you live at 123 Main Street, is, of course, the easiest thing in the world. But if you're poor and Native American and you live on a reservation, it turned out to be a big hurdle. Well, that could affect the outcome of an election. And more importantly, why should these voters who are otherwise eligible to vote be disenfranchised because they don't have a street address, because they're, you know, too poor to live in an area where they've developed street addresses? So that's one answer. And the other answer is some of the guarantees that we have are the product of Supreme Court decisions that this current Supreme Court might at some point overturn. One of the early stories I tell in the book is about a Texas constitutional provision that disenfranchised members of the military. It said if you were not a Texas resident before you joined the military, you were not allowed to vote in Texas elections. Texas said, we want to say voting for people who lived here longer, who are not part of the military. The military voters could swamp our elections. And this case, the plaintiff, Sergeant Herbert Carrington, had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get the right to vote. And so today your right to vote may be secure, but who knows what the future would be? All of us should have a right to vote affirmatively protected in the United States Constitution.
I want to dig into another part of your amendment, Rick, the equal weighting of votes. And I'm sure you know, big issue here in Wisconsin, redistricting, gerrymandering, things like that. Something I didn't know before I read your book, the requirement that each district in a state legislature or congressional district has to be roughly the same population, it has not always been that way. And you point out we could go back to the old way, skewing votes. Could you talk about the importance of that part of your proposed amendment?
Sure. Well, you know, before the decisions by the Supreme Court in the 1960s, we had some wildly unequal voting. So, for example, where I am in California, the largest and smallest counties in the state had the same representation in our state Senate. What I tell my students is we're going to hold an election on what the form of our final exam will be, have 50 students in the class. They each get one vote and I get 100 votes. So we could hold that election. They wouldn't be disenfranchised because they'd all get to vote, but my vote would be determinative. It's the same kind of thing if you don't have equal weighting of votes. And so again, today we have equal weighting of votes thanks to some decisions, including famously Reynolds versus Sims and Baker versus Carr. These are Supreme Court cases from the 1960s, but I'm not convinced that the current Supreme Court would necessarily uphold those if they were challenged. And so why not put it in the Constitution itself?
Another part of the resolution, the amendment you suggest, has to do with the balance of power between the Supreme Court and Congress. Now, with the 13th to 15th Amendments, the ones after the Civil War, they all end with something like Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. The Supreme Court over the years, in many cases, ruled that Congress does not, in fact, have that power. Can you talk about how the balance of power, as you see it, has gone out of whack when it comes to enforcing federal election laws?
Well, so there are both cases about Congress's power, and there are cases about state power. So when it comes to Congress's power, the most important recent case is Shelby County versus Holder. That's where the Supreme Court said that the part of the Voting Rights Act that required jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination in voting to get federal approval and show that their laws would not make minority voters worse off, that this provision that had been in place since 1965 and had been repeatedly upheld as constitutional was no longer constitutional. It exceeded Congress's power. So this kind of decision from the Supreme Court treats Congress kind of as a junior partner when it comes to protecting voting rights. And my amendment, through various technical ways, would change all of that. The other thing that we've seen is, and this has happened in cases that have come from all over the country, including from Wisconsin, a state imposes some kind of voting impediment or restriction. The people who feel that they're aggrieved by it challenge it. And those cases go to the court under something that's called the Anderson-Burdick balancing test. And putting the technicalities aside, what it basically does is it instructs lower courts to put a thumb on the scale favoring the state. So the state just has to posit an interest in preventing fraud or promoting voter confidence. But if plaintiffs want to show a burden, they've got to come up with a ton of evidence to show that they're being seriously burdened in order for this law to be found to be unconstitutional. I would flip this and say, make the states come up with evidence to show that they have a real important reason, supported by actual evidence, to impose barriers on eligible voters. Of course, we need to have some rules in place to assure that our elections are being conducted fairly and with integrity. But a lot of the rules that are put in place are not being done for that reason. They're being done for other reasons, and the courts need to be putting that emphasis on voting rights rather than emphasis on deferring to states.
Rick Hassan is with us talking about his new book. It's called A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. He says the U.S. Constitution needs an amendment that directly guarantees the right to vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree? Do you have questions for our guest about how this might work? Concerns about the idea? Coming up, we'll look at what it would take to make that happen. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Rick Hassan, law professor at UCLA, about his new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Rick, before we go to our callers, I want to talk a little bit about how. Now, the way we usually amend the Constitution, which happens rarely, is through the congressional procedure, then ratified by states. Long story short, it would take some serious bipartisan support to make that happen. Could that happen?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's really hard to get a constitutional amendment. The last one we had related to voting was in 1971, making it unconstitutional to discriminate against 18 to 21-year-olds who were being sent off to the Vietnam War. That was 1971, before most Americans were born. We've kind of lost our muscle memory when it comes to passing these things. It requires two-thirds of each House of Congress and three-quarters of the states to agree. So that's really tough. So, you know, why am I even proposing something when Democrats couldn't even pass voting rights legislation the last time they controlled the Congress in 2020 to 2022? Well, I would say we have to have a longer time horizon. So I mentioned the case of Virginia Minor, the woman who went to the Supreme Court in 1874 and asked for the right to vote, being denied her because she was a woman. After that case, when the Supreme Court said it's a matter of state law, we saw a movement that took four decades. It was not until 1920 that the Constitution was amended to provide for the 19th Amendment that bars discrimination in voting on the basis of sex. Along the way, people organized state by state. So by the time we get to 1920, 30 states had reached the point where they had changed their state constitutions to give equal voting rights to women. And so I foresee a similar thing here. We need to organize around voting rights, not be spending every election lurching from crisis to crisis, but instead thinking more long term, being more imaginative about what it would take to have a democracy where we don't have to worry every time we hold an election, whether things are going to be done in a fair way, whether people are going to be disenfranchised, whether there's going to be fraud. I mean, this is just not the way most other democracies do their business.
Let's bring on a caller now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. My question is, how would this amendment affect voters who want to vote, but they are felons? Every state is different, but I think of a place like Florida where I think it went to the Supreme Court and they said, yes, felons can vote, but then Florida put up all kinds of obstacles, like you have to pay your fine before you can vote, other obstacles.
Barbara, I gotcha. And Rick, you mentioned that in your baseline, it could be, the language could include non-felons. As Barbara says, each state defines how long that felony affects your voting. You get into Florida and the referendum they had there. How would your proposed amendment affect felons at voting?
So the basic amendment, as we talked about with those six provisions, I would leave things as is, letting it be a state-by-state issue. I think today there are 8 states where felons don't just about automatically get back their voting rights when they complete their sentences. But in the add-ons, where I talk about if we were going to be more imaginative and more protective of democracy, what would we do? I certainly would ban the disenfranchisement of people who've completed their felony sentences. And I do use the example of Florida. In Florida, both Democrats and Republicans, voters voted overwhelmingly for an initiative that did just that, restored the voting rights of people who finished their felony sentences. And then the state legislature came in and they messed with the rules. And today, that amendment is kind of a dead letter. It does not make it easy for people to who had felony sentences to be able to vote. And so rather than letting the political process work it out, the Florida experience convinced me that the better course would be to just eliminate felon disenfranchisement as a permissible category.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Back to your calls with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I am with you 100% on the idea of a national ID. I think that would bring us together as a country. I think it's a positive step forward. But my question to you is, how would we incorporate people who live off the grid or who otherwise, are American citizens, but they choose not to participate, or the Amish, for example, who are exercising their religious liberty?
Sure. I don't get into much of the detail of this in the book, but the requirement of identification will be coupled with universal voter registration. So each state would have to go out and proactively register all voters, and people will be registered so long as they're eligible for their entire lives. When they move from state to state, because there would be an ID number that would go with them, we'd be able to cancel the registration in one state and add it to the other. Of course, people who have a conscientious objection, they would have to be allowed not to register if they didn't want to. And people who have, for example, a religious objection to being photographed, there would have to be accommodations made for them consistent with First Amendment protections for freedom of religion. But for most people, having this kind of ID would actually be a kind of benefit because, there are all kinds of problems that people face because they don't have a good ID. The difference between what I'm proposing in terms of ID and what exists in some states like Wisconsin is the government would be going out and registering people and helping people get those IDs. So the government would be paying all the costs. If you have to get a birth certificate, you have to otherwise verify who you are. There would be systems in place. So it wouldn't be just a narrow list of IDs. We wouldn't be fighting over whether college student identifications are good enough or anything like that.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. In our last couple of minutes, Rick, I want to talk about your ideas and how they might affect a situation like 2020, where a losing candidate goes through a lot of effort to try to subvert the outcome of the election. How, if your right to vote constitutional amendment had been in place, how might that have gone differently?
Well, first of all, the basis for the fake electors scheme, which I'm sure you've been hearing a lot about in your state, is this idea that state legislatures could somehow swoop in and appoint alternative slates of electors. Now, I believe even under existing law and under the law that existed in 2020, that would be impermissible. But this constitutional amendment would say it in a very clear way. Voters are the ones. So within each state, within Wisconsin, it would be the vote of the voters that would determine which state would get the candidate would get the state's electoral college votes. Similarly, because the Constitution would protect a right to vote and a right to cast a meaningful vote, if there were complaints about software that is potentially being manipulated or election officials who are not doing their job and fairly administering the election, counting the right to vote, voters would have the standing under this amendment to be able to sue and have a federal court examine whether an election is being fairly conducted. So there's something in it for everybody if you want to assure free and fair elections, because it will provide a check on the power of those who run elections to make sure they're doing it fairly. And it would prevent anyone like a state legislature from coming in and trying to disenfranchise voters claiming they have the right to determine the outcome of the election.
Rick, real briefly, you're a big name in election law circles. Are you getting any emails from members of Congress or state lawmakers saying, tell me more, what can we do?
There is some interest, and we'll see. There have been proposals after the 15th Amendment in the 1960s, after 2000. So this issue has come and gone, but maybe now we'll finally get some momentum so we don't go through a crisis every 4 years with our elections.
Rick, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Richard Hassan, professor of law at UCLA, author of the new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You can keep sharing your thoughts. You can email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments challenging a federal policy that seeks to limit industrial air pollution that crosses state lines. This good neighbor rule, which went into effect last year, is meant to help states achieve better air quality even if they live downwind of other states with high emissions from power plants and other sources. The challenge was brought by lawyers representing three states and several major corporations. They argue that the good neighbor rule is too costly, could cause problems with the electric grid. Supporters of the policy say it's been effective in reducing air pollution, which is harmful to human health, associated with millions of deaths worldwide each year. Our next guest is an expert in environmental law and health sciences. We're taking a look at what this latest Supreme Court challenge could mean for air quality around the country and here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about air pollution in Wisconsin? Do you or someone in your family have asthma or health conditions that are affected by local air quality? Do you think the federal government should be more involved in regulating air quality, or should some of these decisions be left up to states? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tye is professor at the UW Law School and associate dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. The research examines the interactions between environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as always, when you start to dig into these things, it gets complicated. I want to take one piece at a time. First of all, can you talk a little bit about the good neighbor concept when it comes to federal regulation of air pollutants?
Yeah, the idea is to address the fact that air doesn't stay in one state. So if you emit a pollutant, it's going to circulate. And it usually circulates from upwind states to downwind states. The Clean Air Act has a lot of provisions for each state controlling its air pollution, but it doesn't. Those other provisions don't really help when most of the air pollutants are coming from some other state. So the good neighbor provision is designed to do that. To address what happens when you have cross-state air pollution that may affect the health of another state, but is not actually created by that state itself.
Now, in this particular challenge to EPA rulemaking, the pollutants in question here are chemical emissions that cause ozone formation. Can you talk a little bit about why that is a concerning kind of pollution that we worry about?
Yeah, so there's many health effects that are associated with ozone pollution and also fine particulate pollution, which is also something that's being controlled by the cross-state air pollution rule. And the idea, the problem with these types of pollutants is that one, it can sort of exacerbate anyone with asthma, having, sort of leading to even more additional effects, but also some of the fine particulate matter pollution and also ozone pollution have been connected to neurological effects, has been connected to lower educational scores on tests, and also has increased the frequency of miscarriages. So there's a lot of different types of health effects that can arise out of these sorts of pollutants.
Okay, those are a couple of the basics. Now tell us about the EPA rule under this good neighbor concept on ozone that's being challenged in the courts, a little of the history and what it was trying to do.
Yeah, so this is, I have to sort of unpack the Clean Air Act itself. So what the Clean Air Act does, it sets forth a number of different sort of national ambient air quality standards, basically standards for certain types of pollutants, or allows the EPA to set forth certain national ambient air quality standards. So these are standards for level of pollutants that all states have to hit. Now, it doesn't tell the states how to do that. What instead it does is that the states can go through and design their own implementation plan. So what that means is that, you know, a state can choose to support one type of industry over another type of industry, so long as whatever it does, according to the EPA, actually helps hit the national ambient air quality standards. Now, the problem with that is, right, a state can have a great state implementation plan, but as I mentioned before, it could be a neighboring state that is actually leading to the initial state not meeting those national ambient air quality standards. So what the Clean Air Act also allows the EPA to do is to create a cross-state air pollutant rule that ends up substituting for certain kinds of features a federal implementation plan in order for those downwind states to reach their national ambient air quality standards. And that's what's being challenged here. The rule sets out requirements for 23 upwind states to meet their obligations under the Clean Air Act not to contribute to downwind states' violation of these health-based standards. And it sets forth basically a phase-in of certain types of technologies that must be adopted.
As I understand it, Steph, Wisconsin is on both sides of this. We are subject to this EPA rule, one of those 23, I think, states you just mentioned, but also we're victims as a downwind state as we try to solve our ozone pollution problem here. We're getting some pollution from upwind states, so we're affected on both ends. Do I have that right?
Yep.
So let's get into that challenge now that you mentioned. A lot of states have challenged this in different courts as well as corporations. Tell us a little bit about the challenges and why they jumped up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So this is unusual for it to jump up to the Supreme Court at this type of stage. Usually these get addressed at appellate court kind of levels. Basically, the Clean Air Act says that any kind of appeal of a rulemaking from the EPA goes to various appellate courts, either the D.C. Circuit or the circuit court where the impacts are being felt. It is very unusual for this to go to the Supreme Court at this kind of stage without any kind of resolution at the appellate court level. My guess is that part of the reason why folks took it to the Supreme Court is they think they have a sympathetic Supreme Court right now, which it seems like, according to the accounts of the oral arguments I've read, it seems like they are fairly sympathetic to the states bringing the challenge.
Talking to Steph Tai, professor at the UW Law School and associate dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, looking at EPA air pollution regulations, the good neighbor rules that say, hey, states, you have to regulate not just when it comes to your own air quality, but what you're sending downwind to neighboring states. You can join in with your questions about all of this, your thoughts on how much authority the federal government should have to regulate air pollution in states. What you want to see from the U.S. Supreme Court, where this ended up. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steph, let's dig into the arguments now from the states that are challenging this EPA policy, from the corporations that are challenging it. What are their arguments as to why why the EPA is going too far here?
So they raise two types of arguments. One is just the sort of policy-based argument, which is that this is going to be too costly for them to comply with. But they also raise a legal argument that is fairly unusual. Basically, they're arguing that in setting these standards, the EPA did not consider thoroughly enough what happens if some states, like those states, drop out of the good neighbor provision for reasons of objecting to it. It's unusual because, and I have to backtrack a little bit here.
Sure.
It's unusual because of the process of rulemaking. What happens when any agency issues a rule under the Administrative Procedure Act, they have to put it out for notice and comment. That is, they have to publish a draft rule, and then there's usually 30 or 60 days for people to comment on it. And these states had the opportunity to comment, and none of them raised this at the notice and comment stage. In usual administrative law terms, this would be regarded as having waived that kind of argument, which is why I mentioned that this is fairly unusual that the Supreme Court is hearing this argument that the EPA failed to adequately consider all of the implications of particular states dropping out. They didn't raise that. And if they had raised this at the notice and comment stage, then the EPA would have had in its final rule some more discussion of this. And so in a way, it's kind of like a bait and switch that happened here. And the other thing too that is sort of unusual is that under the EPA's method of determining what types of standards to set, it's not particularly dependent on how many states participate in this. It's a technology-based standard based on a national survey of available technologies. And so whether or not they adequately considered what would happen if various states dropped out of participating in the program isn't actually even related to the calculus that the EPA used in setting these standards.
This is about ozone in particular. Could this end up affecting other EPA regulations under the Clean Air Act? What else could be at stake here?
So I mentioned this ozone is also particulate matter, but this is very, so let me backtrack on this a little bit. This particular argument is very isolated to the cross-state air pollution rule because it's a very different part of the Clean Air Act than the other parts of the Clean Air Act. So I think it's limited in that sense to its ability to regulate cross-state air pollution. However, the fact that the Supreme Court is likely to grant an emergency stay, that sets a precedent for many other types of challenges to other parts of the Clean Air Act and rules under those parts of the Clean Air Act. And so that could have even greater implications for the ability of the EPA to regulate air pollutants.
Steph Tai is with us, professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, associate dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. We're taking a look at this challenge to the EPA's good neighbor rule to limit ozone air pollution crossing state lines. The U.S. Supreme Court heard it, as Steph mentioned, in kind of a surprising way, waiting to see what they do now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see from the U.S. Supreme Court on this rule that regulates interstate air pollution? Do you have questions for our guest if you're feeling a little confused on this? There's a lot of moving parts. You are not alone if you need some kind of clarification. Do you worry about trends when it comes to the Supreme Court and how it rules on environmental issues in general? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW Law Professor Steph Tai about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing last week on the EPA's good neighbor rule and how it could affect states like Wisconsin that deal with air pollution crossing state lines. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the legal and environmental issues at stake here? Are you someone who worries about air quality because of your asthma or someone in your family with a sensitive condition that makes you vulnerable to air pollution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steph, you never want to read too much into the questioning from Supreme Court justices in any particular case and predict outcomes. That said, given what went down last week at the Supreme Court on this issue, what kind of things did you hear from justices that that made you think?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the justices are really buying into the state's arguments that first, even though they didn't raise this below, that the EPA's failure to consider what would happen if any states dropped out of the good neighbor provision. They're seeming to think that that's meritorious enough to potentially grant a stay, and that also the stay, so let me backtrack again a bit. So in order to grant a stay, you need to balance two things, right? The sort of public interest, which includes the cost to people, and the likelihood of success on the merits. And so it seems like the Supreme Court is looking at both and saying, okay, well, might you succeed on the merits, even though I personally think this is quite unusual. And then two, that the financial harm that would be done to these states is sufficient to grant a stay. And so on both of those prongs for consideration of whether to grant a stay, at least listening to the or reading the oral arguments, it does seem like the Supreme Court is ready to rule in favor of Ohio and Indiana and West Virginia.
If the U.S. Supreme Court does that, what happens then? Can the EPA go back to the drawing board, draw up a new set of rules, or what would happen next in that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, they can. That's definitely a possibility. What has been also weird with this particular Supreme Court is that I don't know whether or not that would stop the Supreme Court from still intervening. So let me give an example. So under the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, this was challenged, then it was taken down by the Trump administration, and then there was no plan in place. The Supreme Court still heard a challenge to the plan somehow in West Virginia versus EPA, even though the Biden administration said, we're not even going to introduce anything like the Clean Power Plan again. So the Supreme Court has demonstrated that it's willing to hear even rules that don't exist, which makes me suspect that even if the Biden administration tries to redo the cross-state air pollution rule, the Supreme Court might still somehow rule on the merits of this rule, which would be really strange, but is not inconsistent with what it did in West Virginia versus EPA.
Now, supposing this rule is in place and stays in place, what kind of things are states needing to do? I know power plants are part of the story, but not all of the story. What kind of changes would be out there to accommodate these rules and say, okay, we're not going to contribute to this ozone pollution in, say, our neighbors to the east?
It's pretty much power plants and putting in certain technological measures in order to address the nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide coming from these power plants. So it is really primarily a sort of technological phase in. And it's not like a hard limit. It's done as a phase in so that the emission budgets will decline over time rather than being a state of the art installation right at the immediate part.
And what is the timeline on that phase in?
Nitrogen oxides, it doesn't even start until 2026. I can't remember, unfortunately, the actual timeline of the phase-in, but it's definitely not immediate.
Talking to Steph Tighe from the UW Law School and Associate Dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, looking at the Supreme Court case I heard last week, kind of jumped up through the court system there, looking at EPA regulation of air pollution in states under the good neighbor rule, meaning, hey, are your emissions your state affecting another state? In this case, the pollutant in question is ozone. Still time for your calls with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences if this kind of air pollution is something that affects you personally. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steph, looking at the Clean Air Act, I mean, sometimes Congress passes laws that leave some ambiguity for the way that then the executive branch deploys those laws, regulates and enforces them. Is this a case where it would be worth revisiting the Clean Air Act to clarify some of these issues?
Well, let me see. So two things. I'm not sure that the issue here involves any kind of matter of clarity in this instance. It's really about a procedural, a procedure that the states are claiming that the EPA did not follow. So I, in, at least with respect to this case, I don't think any additional clarity is necessary. But that said, given the Supreme Court arguments heard earlier this year in two cases known as Loper-Bright and also Relentless, the Supreme Court is revisiting, and nobody really knows what they're going to do with this yet, whether or not an agency gets any deference if it's interpreting an unclear or ambiguous aspect of a statute. So given how the Supreme Court is moving in those two cases, in general, it would be helpful, I think, for Congress to add additional clarity to statutes. Whether or not it actually will in this gridlocked Congress seems unlikely at this time.
Let's bring on a caller. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. A while ago, our power plants had scrubbers, and the DNR had monitors where they would monitor the air. Also, the biggest problem we have with ozone is landfills. There's apartment buildings that don't have to recycle. There's businesses. There's even government that doesn't have to recycle. Okay, you can go anywhere. You'll never find two garbage cans. You'll never find one for recycling and garbage. Maybe a library you will. But, I mean, they don't even follow their own rules.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Now, first of all, I believe there are still scrubbers in coal plants. A lot of that will take out carbon, greenhouse gas emissions. Is that part of the technology we're talking about when it comes to ozone-causing emissions, Steph?
Yep, pretty much. And the problem with landfills is that that's not something that's really available for federal regulation. That's considered a core state and municipal kind of issue because it's about land use. And so to the extent that the federal government can do much about it, it can issue guidances, it can make recommendations, but it can't really regulate in that area. And the Clean Air Act doesn't give it the authority to do so.
Thanks for that call, Mary Kay, at 800-642-1234. Janet joins us now in La Crosse. Janet, hi.
Hi. Yes. My question and comments that I wanted to ask your guests deal with a number of the environmental laws that have come up in the last few years and the rulings on them. Most recently, now the wetlands laws have been changed, so Fish and Wildlife no longer have as much control, or I believe that's who would have the wetlands. Indiana's leading the way on that. So I'm seeing sort of a continuity going on here with our current Supreme Court, that they're not necessarily looking at what is and what are the mandates.
Gotcha.
But
Janet, we're just about out of time. In just our last minute or so, Steph, what kind of trends are you seeing with the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to environmental regulation?
Yeah, it seems like they're very skeptical of environmental regulations, and they're more primarily concerned with the cost of complying with environmental regulations versus the health effects and the health benefits that are associated with environmental regulations. And so they're really focused on the sort of industry costs versus some of the very strong public health benefits that also have, you know, monetary benefits. They're not really focused on that.
Janet, thanks for the call. And Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Steph Tai is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Associate Dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Been talking about an ongoing U.S. Supreme Court case heard last week. It involves the EPA's good neighbor rule on air pollution that's emitted in one state but causes problems in a downwind state, what it could mean for regulating air quality around the country and here in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts. Email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. Hey, it is $10 Tuesday. Today, only get the new WPR t-shirt when you make a gift of $10 a month. That's to help get ahead of our one-day member drive tomorrow. One day, yeah, usually this would be a whole week of member drive. This time, we're trying to do it all in one day to minimize interruptions to the shows. Will it work? I don't know yet. You'll provide steady and vital support for the WPR programs you value. You'll show off your commitment to independent journalism and inspiring entertainment with your new shirt. And you'll help make this one-day member drive concept a success. And maybe we can do it again. Give now. Ask for your shirt at WPR.org/donate. If you love grammar, here's something to think about. A long-running debate has been ruled on, and the conclusion? A preposition is something that you can end a sentence with. This is something that the folks at Merriam-Webster Dictionary looked into. Back in school, I learned that prepositions like with, on, about, into, and so on had to go in the middle of sentences, not at the end of. But Merriam-Webster says that rule wasn't part of the English language back before. Some grammarians tried to make English work like Latin. It's been that way ever since. Maybe this is something you're angry over. Well, you could share your thoughts at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org is where you could send an email to. Your message is something that I will definitely look at. Central Time continues just ahead. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When it comes to watching television, we have more choices than ever to find shows, movies, and other videos to watch on our big screens. As the traditional broadcast, cable, and satellite providers battle with streaming services like Netflix and Hulu for our subscription dollars and our eyeballs, another player in the digital video industry has quietly moved to the forefront. According to data from Nielsen, the top streaming service we use on our TVs, not just our computer screens or phones, it's YouTube. Not their paid service, YouTube TV, but the regular free video social media platform. Viewers are spending more and more time watching videos on YouTube. That cuts into the time they might otherwise spend watching cable or streaming services. That doesn't include the time spent watching on our phones, whether it's YouTube or TikTok in the short-form video market. It's creating a new landscape for TV producers and their audiences as they compete not just for our dollars, but our attention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you watch YouTube or TikTok? What size screen do you watch those on? Have those videos on those social media platforms replace some or most of your screen time? What do you think of the quality of videos on YouTube and other social media? Do you prefer premium content you might pay for on a streaming service? Do you do these things two at a time, double screening? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonathan Gray is a professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, where he researches how media, entertainment, and its audiences interact. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Derek Johnson is department chair and professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, who focuses on media industries. Derek, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, why do you think audiences, especially but not exclusively younger viewers, have gravitated toward YouTube as a top streaming service?
Yeah, so I mean, two things I'd throw out there. I mean, I'm sure there are many more, but one is just access. I think when I talk to audiences, a lot of times there's a lot of confusion about, you know, they hear you should watch this show, but which service is on that? Is that on? Oh, I don't have that service. And as more and more people have cut the cord, and almost everyone has internet access. And so YouTube is just there. I think the other thing is that YouTube picked up a lot of kids. A lot of kids had tablets or they could get onto YouTube Kids. And so they became YouTube addicts at a very early age. And YouTube has tons of content for kids. And so we're starting to see a point where some of those have aged up. And so it's not just getting the kids now, it's also getting the teens and the 20s.
And Derek, in my head, you know, watching a TV show or a movie on a streaming service versus watching some clips on YouTube are different activities. But it sounds like Netflix's and Hulu's of the world see YouTube as a threat. Can you talk about how this is affecting those industries?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are a threat. They're a competitor in the sense that you can find them in the same spaces, right? You pull up your device and you can choose between different apps. You can choose between Netflix. You can choose between YouTube. Like, there's only so much time in the day. So anything that might take up our attention on a screen is potentially competing with one another. But I also think it's true that while there's competition, there's also collaboration. And a lot of these companies work together. YouTube is a great site of promotion for traditional legacy television companies, television studios that create content for NBC or CBS also might create content for Netflix. So, you know, there's a lot of overlap and cooperation between these companies. So there might be like a competition mm-hmm. for dominance, but it's also an ecosystem where like these companies rely upon one another. And, you know, if one was to go extinct, like that might be good for another competitor, but could have real implications for them too, for the ways that they depend on one another.
And John, for viewer perception, I know in the days of, you know, print newspapers, people in the industry saw a real difference between the editorial page and the news pages. So here on radio, I think of the newscast as one thing and the talk show as another thing. I know that readers of newspapers and viewers or listeners to radio, it's all one thing. How do we think of this as a whole bunch of different activities, viewing on little screens, viewing on big screens, or is it all just part of, this media environment, and it's all the same to the viewers?
Yeah, I think to many viewers, that's true. I mean, I constantly hear people tell me that they don't watch television anymore, and then they'll tell me about all the shows they think are great, meaning they're watching on their laptop or, you know, they're watching on their phone. And I think so many of us are watching on so many different devices that as we, you know, move from one to the other, we're not necessarily sort of marking the distinctions and the differences as much as used to be the case.
I want to talk, Derek, about the people creating content. If I run Netflix, well, for a while I was producing all this original Netflix content and or bringing on stuff from other producers. If I'm YouTube, I think they dabble a little in original content, but it's mainly user created or people showing clips of stuff from everything else. How does this competition affect the stuff that gets made in the first place these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex environment of content creation where, you know, YouTube does pay for content in the sense that it cuts its content creators. If they reach a certain threshold, right, you get a portion of the advertising revenue. So, you know, YouTube does have content expenses when it cuts those creators in. You know, but everyone has their own model, right? Like Netflix will pay you up front if you're a content producer trying to make television for them. You'll see a bigger upfront payment for that content. Whereas if you're working in the old network system, right, it's going to take years before you see, a profit from the show that you make because it's got to go through one market after another before you start to see those profits. So it all just, you know, everyone has their different model of monetizing and compensating content creators.
Talking to Derek Johnson and Jonathan Gray, both with the Media and Cultural Studies Department at UW-Madison, looking at the ever-changing world of what we watch on a screen, from the old days of broadcast TV to cable, then streaming, now YouTube and TikTok becoming dominant forces in capturing our eyeballs and trying to make money out of our attention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you how your viewing habits have and haven't changed over the years. Younger listeners, do you have a big screen to watch things on, or is it all on your phone? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. John, when it comes to the stuff we see, I mean, I get, you know, there's a TikTok style, there are YouTube styles. How much do those formats shape the content that we end up seeing on them?
I mean, the short formness of it is the key thing, I think, for many people. I mean, what's weird, too, is all the platforms borrow from each other. You know, like my daughter watches YouTube and she thinks I'm a magician because I've seen things on Instagram, you know, 2 weeks before she has. But if you're on TikTok, you've seen it 3 months before I've seen it. But it's the short formness, I think, that's key. I think people can still often spend as much time watching, but instead of watching, say, one 45-minute episode or, you know, three sitcoms in a row, you're watching, you know, 800 small clips of something.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that experience. Like, oh, I don't have the commitment right now to watch a TV show. I'll watch a video or two, and then pretty soon I've watched the exact same block of time. Now, for Netflix, say, Derek, how much of a worry is that? I don't see Netflix coming out with a series of, you know, 45-second videos to try to compete with that.
No, I don't think that's Netflix's model. I think Netflix's model is actually fairly traditional, right? Like they're bringing television to us in a new way via streaming platform, but they're looking at long form content. They want to produce television series. They want to produce, feature films. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be in the pipeline for Netflix to be developing
that. Is that a worry, do you think, for people in the industry? If I'm producing 2-hour movies or 45-minute long TV shows, am I worried that there's a generation being trained to watch things in 1 minute at most increments?
I think yes. To just give you a simple answer, that seems absolutely possible.
Go ahead, John. Yeah.
For me, I think one of the key questions is it generational, or like will they grow out of it, or is this what the generation is doing? And if I was a content creator, or if I was Netflix, that's where I'd be really worried is this group 10 years from now all going to be watching shows like we are, or is this the end of it?
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Kenosha. Jim, hi.
Hi. So Google buys YouTube. What's it been since 2006? They're a very rich country, and I wanted YouTube to be a source of news for me. Try the news thing. They get stuff that's dated. Why can't they have YouTube reporters? Why can't they throw some of their millions and millions of dollars to be a legitimate news source?
Jim, interesting. I don't know that. I mean, YouTube has videos that people produce, that networks might produce, and other news sources that end up on YouTube. It doesn't seem like YouTube has at all gone into, we are going to be an original content source when it comes to news.
No, I mean, there was a brief time where YouTube was trying to develop content for its subscription service. But I think largely YouTube presents itself as the distributor, right? It's up to the users of YouTube to actually produce the content. And that's actually very convenient for YouTube in that it takes a lot of responsibility away from them. It's not their job to approve the content, to make sure that we're getting, high quality journalism. It's just to provide the platform in which people would use it.
And thanks for that call, Jim. John, we've been mostly focusing on, fiction, TV shows and movies. But as these as all these platforms change and evolve, is news getting squeezed out in some way? I know a lot of news departments have in various newspapers and elsewhere. Where do you see news going in this platform war?
Yeah, I mean, it's struggling, right? I mean, there lots of people are happy to. Lots of platforms are happy to distribute and to circulate, but the amount of money that comes out of that is often negligible. So, I mean, we see this, the number of venues that can actually do reporting, actually pay the money to look into a story rather than just read something off YouTube or off Google. That's going down. I mean, I'm not an optimist about the future of journalism.
It costs money to create it. And so if we can offload that to the user who's going to be the producer, it's up to the users to produce good news. And, if that's it's really on the user of YouTube and all of us collectively who are using the platform to decide, is this going to be a good platform for news or not? And I kind of share Jonathan's pessimism about the decision that we seem to have made here.
Yeah, I mean, if you want me to throw a bone of optimism, it is right that one of the challenges that led a lot of people away from the established news is the idea of three great men who could tell you everything. and one of the things that YouTube does provide is the possibility to expand the number of voices. Now, some of those voices are crazy. Some of them are wrong. Some of them are peddling conspiracy theories, but some of them are also giving, sides of a story that you otherwise wouldn't hear.
And we also shouldn't pretend that the legacy news organizations weren't already disinvesting in their journalism divisions before YouTube hit the scene.
Sure.
We're talking to UW-Madison Media Studies professors Jonathan Gray and Derek Johnson about video apps like YouTube and TikTok as competition for television and streaming services. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much of your video consumption comes from YouTube and TikTok or Instagram or the Reels on Facebook? The list goes on and on. Have you moved into particular streaming services? Have you moved on from streaming services? Or do you prefer the good old days of broadcast TV or cable or whatever era is your media golden age? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about YouTube, TikTok, and other social media platforms as top competitors to TV and streaming services. Our guests today are UW-Madison Media and Cultural Studies professors Jonathan Gray and Derek Johnson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear about your screen viewing habits. Do you find yourself watching more and more, say, on YouTube and less on streaming services? Where are you in your evolution on how and what you watch on screens, big and small? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Want to give a listen to comedian Jon Stewart, who recently returned after a hiatus to hosting The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He took an audience question about whether TV is dying as more people just watch videos on their phones.
Don't you still watch TV, but you just watch it on your computer?
On TikTok, on your phone.
Right, but you understand that that's still TV. It's just you're watching it in a different delivery service. It's like heroin is heroin, whether you snort it or shoot it. It's still an opiate for the masses, as is television. You're just getting it in smaller bites, but it's still TV. We make it.
You could join in. Let us know how you get your TV, whatever you want to call it, whatever form, 800-642-1234. Jonathan, during the break, we were talking about how YouTube and other platforms serve stuff up for us. I think a lot of us have been paralyzed. I think back in the days of video stores, you know, paralyzed by the choice out there. And how do you make that decision? Well, now algorithms make it for us. Do we like that?
Well, I mean, when I do audience research, I like there's one group of people who just love studying and working out what they're going to watch. But I hear more and more people that really love things like YouTube or TikTok or Instagram because they do the work for them. It's funny because there's something nostalgic when I listen to them. It makes me think of the great experience of like watching cable TV when you've got 100 channels and you can just keep watching and it's the kind of miasma of it. Nominally your thumb's doing something, but you kind of forgotten it is. And I think that there's a joy for some people of not needing to sort of, you know, go and read the critics and find out which service is on and make the selection. You just turn it on and it'll just keep following, you know, the next recommendation. Watch that. Click, click, click. Keep going. An hour later, you're done.
Yeah. I mean, Netflix has recommendations too, but I find like Netflix still does require a fair amount of like input in order to get going. Like you still have, they're going to give you lots of recommendations, but you still have to make a choice. And that can still feel, I think, overwhelming to a lot of viewers.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is a lot of times I've heard this from people I've interviewed where they, when I ask them how good the recommendations from Netflix are, they think the recommendations from Netflix are really bad, but they think the recommendations that YouTube or TikTok gave them for shows they should watch on Netflix are really good. So they like those algorithms, just not the Netflix one.
Let's go back to our callers. Darlene is with us in Merrill. Darlene, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Darlene?
I just wanted to say I was listening to you guys through the Ideas Network on my, you know, streaming it on my TV. But I like to hear the news from broadcasting, from regular TV, you know, internet these days, you know, people can put different things on there. You know, it's, do you believe it or not? I just like to get the news since I was a kid. Mm. And I just think that's the best way to go.
All right, Darlene, thanks for the call. Derek, thoughts on authority, I guess, reliability of sources as people encounter them in different mediums?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is about authority, but, you know, I really appreciated Darlene's comment because one of the things that I find is hardest to find in the current environment is local I mean, even like national broadcast news programming, right? Like there's a lot. The streaming economy is set up to deliver us our entertainment programming, but it's a lot harder to get your local news or anything that's carried on your local broadcast affiliate in the streaming environment. It's not impossible, but it's trickier.
Of course. Now, I keyed in on something else Darlene just said there. She's listening to us a radio show on her TV. I don't know. That means something, Jonathan. I don't know what.
Yeah. I mean, all the media have just sort of blended into the one these days. As I said earlier, you know, the people who don't think they're watching TV because they're watching it on the internet, or people who say they don't listen to any radio because, again, it's on the internet, but they're listening.
I've had people say, I like your podcast, Rob. And I'm like, yeah. What podcast? Just the archive version of this show. Yeah.
So I sat on the Peabody board for a few years judging. And what I loved is even the board members, there was a category called radio podcast. And in the first few years, everyone just called it the radio category. And then in the last few years, everyone just called it the podcast category, no matter what was in it. And people would say that was a great radio show when it was a podcast, or that's a great podcast. But
what I think is interesting about that, we all seem to agree, Jon Stewart agrees, that like it's all the same thing. But what you're describing is people still have a sense that it is different in some way, right? They strongly believe they are not watching television. And so even as things are converging, those perceived boundaries still seem to matter quite a bit.
I want to, you mentioned the word nostalgia earlier, and in my head, and maybe it's because I do live radio, I are we losing something when we don't have that shared experience where I'm watching this show at the same time as lots of other people? They're not in the room with me, but it's a common shared experience versus we're all experiencing this thing at our leisure when we choose to stream it. Does that mean anything, Derek?
I think that's something that Netflix in particular has struggled with, where, you know, they were innovating in releasing the entire season of a series all at once. And then you would have people burn through it all in one weekend, or some people would wait and burn through it the next weekend. And as a result, there was like, you know, a quick blip of social media conversation about series, but then they'd quickly fall off the radar, right? So a lot of streaming services that followed in the wake of Netflix experimented with, like, well, let's go back to one episode a week, because that allows us to structure that shared experience and all the social media conversation that might come with it a little bit more strategically.
And just 30 seconds, Jonathan, I think sometimes by the time we're talking about a change, the new change is already coming along. What do you have your eye on next to watch for in the world of changing platforms?
Geez. I mean, what I'm most amused by is actually how we're going back to an advertising model. Most of the streamers are forcing ads on, and we're starting to see TV look a lot like it looked 30 years ago.
And look a lot more like YouTube.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Derek, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Jonathan Gray and Derek Johnson. They're professors of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about YouTube and TikTok and how they've challenged streaming services, cable, and broadcast for our time, our money, and our attention. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Beyonce has a new country song out and an album to follow next month. Is it going to get played on country music stations? We'll look at the inner workings of the country music scene and who does and doesn't get to be part of it. And to the moon and beyond, we'll check out the new U.S. lunar probe that landed last week and what it tells us about the future of research in Earth's orbit and out into the solar system with NPR science reporter Joe Palca. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.